David J. Linden is a neuroscientist and endlessly curious, even in the final months of his life. Late last year, Linden was diagnosed with terminal cancer, and in an essay in The Atlantic, he wrote, "I may be dying, but I'm still a science nerd." He explores death and what facing the end of his own life is teaching him about the human mind. I talked to David Linden about that in January, and by the way, he is still alive, still facing the same prognosis. David, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, first, your cancer diagnosis seemed to come out of the blue. Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, sure. I went in for a routine echocardiogram, and they said, "What's this giant thing that's sticking up next to your heart?" And at first, they thought it was a hiatal hernia, which is when your stomach pokes up through the diaphragm and snuggles up next to the sac next to your heart. But it turned out not to be that. Originally, they thought it was a benign growth called a teratoma, but I had surgery to remove it, and then they biopsied it and found that it was actually a malignant cancer called synovial sarcoma and had grown into the wall of my heart, so it was impossible to remove all of it. So it's a unusual cancer in an unusual place.
Yeah, and as a person, as a scientist, how are you processing this diagnosis?
Well, you know, a lot of different ways. One way is that I'm nerding out about it in the sense that when you're a biologist, when you're a biomedical researcher, I work at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, and you go to talk to the doctors, you have a very different experience. The surgeon is showing me his iPhone. He's saying, "Do you want to see pictures of your heart surgery while it was happening?" And I'm nerding out and going, "Yeah, I really want. Oh, do you want to see your tumor?" "Yeah, I really want to see the tumor." And so, you know, in that sense, it is empowering to be a nerd about something really grim, meaning, you know, my own terminal cancer. But I think the more interesting thing is what it has led me to think about the human mind, which is my area as a neuroscientist.
Yeah. Well, and after your diagnosis, you write that you were furious about it shortening your time and at the same time grateful for your love, for your relationships, for your career in neuroscience. Occupying these two mental states at once, is that actually an important finding in neuroscience?
Well, I mean, I think it's something that's really obvious to most people, I'm sure to most of your listeners, but, you know, I'm just a little thick and it had to be brought home to me forcefully by my illness. You know, in neuroscience, we have a tendency to think, oh, well, you have a certain mental state at the moment. You're either resting and digesting or you're fleeing or attacking, that you're either sleepy or you're alert. You're either exploring or you're pulling back. And in truth, you can occupy more than one cognitive state at once, even if these states at first blush would seem to be contradictory, like in my case, gratitude and anger.
Yeah. You also write that there's no objective human experience, that our experiences are colored by our expectations, our circumstance. And one example you write is that of how we conceive of time. Can you talk about that?
Well, sure. Everyone's had the experience about how time can crawl when you're doing something unpleasant, like waiting in line at the Department of Motor Vehicles. But time flies when you're doing something pleasant, like having a nice chat over beer with a friend of yours. Another example I give is the very same caress on the arm with your sweetheart in a loving, connected time feels wonderful. But imagine that very same caress, instead of during a loving, connected time, in the middle of an argument. It doesn't feel the same at all. It feels intrusive and like a bug crawling on you and you want it to end. So all of our human perception is constructed. There is no objective experience in the world. It's all colored by our mood and our expectation.
And as you're right, the concept of 5 years can be really different depending on where you are in life, yeah?
Absolutely. You would think that 5 years of life has a value that's so fundamental that it wouldn't be shifted by expectation or circumstance. But if someone had told me before my diagnosis that I had 5 years left to live, I would have been feeling deeply cheated and offended. But now, with my prognosis of 6 to 18 months of life to live, the idea of five more years seems like an impossible gift. It seems utterly different than it would have in the prior circumstance.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're the person to talk to about how we understand this, the neuroscience part of all of this. Is our brain wired to be able to comprehend our own death that will no longer exist?
Yeah, I think fundamentally it isn't. And what I notice about my own personal experience is that I can do all kinds of real world everyday things to deal with my impending demise, right? I can meet a lawyer and get my will together and make sure my finances are in order. And I can write the letters to support my trainees for when I'm gone for the next stages of their careers, things like that. But when I really try to deeply engage with me or a world without me in it, I find myself failing. My mind skitters over the surface of this. And I don't think that's a personal failing. I think it is telling us something about being human. And the way I was trained in neuroscience 43 years ago when I entered the field was that the brain is fundamentally reactive. You know, we're out there in the world, things impinge on our senses, our eyes, our ears, our skin, and then we make decisions about them, and then we have actions through contracting or relaxing our muscles, creating speech, things of that nature. But it's fundamentally reactive. And one of the great advances of neuroscience in recent years is knowing that the brain is always active. And one of the things it's always doing is predicting the near future. The brain is spending an awful lot of time trying to figure out things like, will I become hungry in the next hour? Is that person approaching me, friend or foe? And the idea that the brain is constantly working to predict the near future presupposes that there will be a near future. And I think in this way, our brains are hardwired to have a problem with truly engaging with our own demise.
In this moment, you're reflecting on the biggest questions of life and death as a neuroscientist. And I want to ask you, you know, what are the big questions that science can answer? And what are the big questions you think that it cannot?
Well, to me, fundamental questions about immortality come up. And one of the things that I've been wondering about when thinking about my own personal inability to engage with my own death, which I think is not just mine, but I think, as I said, is something fundamentally human, is I begin to wonder about how this affects human society and human history. It makes me wonder about the fact that afterlife and reincarnation stories are present all over the world. If you ask a cultural anthropologist, can you find a society where they don't have these? It's almost impossible to find. If you look at the world's major religions, not all of them, but almost all of them have an idea of an afterlife or a reincarnation or a notion of fusion with the divine. But the idea that there is an immortal soul or that there is a mental function that lives on. And what I suspect is that this is actually a bug, that this is a result of the fact that our brains are hardwired to continuously predict the future and thereby to make it very difficult for us to imagine ourselves gone. I think that this is the way this manifests in the species, the way it manifests societally. And we would try to think how much of human history, how much of human society has been determined by religion and by the conflicts between religions. It's astonishing. And I think that this aspect of the brain has molded our humanity in a very fundamental way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, boy, a lot to think about. Finally, David Linden, does it give you any comfort to sort of take a step back and observe the human mind in this way as a neuroscientist, you know, given the time you have left?
It absolutely does. I mean, to me, thinking about the way my own impending death informs me about the human mind is a way for me to take control of my situation, to feel a sense of agency, rather than just being passive and borne along by this this medical problem. I feel that it's given me a way to engage, to think to the end. And that's an enormous gift.
David J. Linden is a neuroscience professor at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and the Kavalian Neuroscience Discovery Institute. And his latest book is Unique, The New Science of Human Individuality. David, we send our best to you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.